for inviting us all to this conference. It's been really interesting so far, and you know, I've actually made some progress based on the thoughts I've had since I've been here, or maybe it's progress. So I'm going to talk about some ideas that originated for, I think, a variety of reasons with me and collaborators. So this is joint work with Manny Cannell, formerly Los Alamos, now Guinness, Gerardo Ortiz, who's a condensed matter physicist in T11 at Los Alamos, Rolando Soma, who is a graduate student at the Institute for Atomic Physics in Bariloche, Argentina, I believe, but he's doing his PhD at Los Alamos with Gerardo and with us, and Lorenzo Viola, who is now at Dartmouth at the Van Atlanta. So, we had a number of reasons for wanting to generalize the notion of entanglement. Gerardo had a strong feeling that entanglement was behind certain condensed matter phenomena, like phase transitions, because entanglement is responsible for correlations, let's say, in pure state. So it must be related to quantum phase transitions, as many people observed. But on the other hand, the correlations, if you look at it, in some condensed matter systems, for instance, systems of indistinguishable particles, might not properly be described as correlations between distinguishable subsystems of some joint system. I mean, there may be modes that are distinguishable, and you can look at correlation between different modes, entanglement between different modes, but perhaps that may not be what you want. You may need some notion of fermionic, entanglement between fermionic particles or bosonic particles. And there have been other authors who've looked at bosonic and fermionic entanglement. Don't have the references off the top of my head, but they're in some of our papers, and I'm sure some of the authors are here. So that was one motivation. Another motivation for me is actually that I'm interested in the foundations of quantum mechanics and the foundations of physics, and I'm actually interested in considering theories that may be more general than quantum mechanics or classical mechanics. Structures that may contain those as special cases on which you can formulate axioms about, let's say, either abstract mathematical axioms, which are beautiful, or axioms about the properties of information processing in these theories. And then you can study, what are the implications of these axioms? Can we characterize quantum mechanics as the theory with exactly this information processing power, and so forth? Okay, so you might therefore want to have a notion of entanglement that generalizes to some of the abstract structures that people use to study these that involve such things as letting the observables be an initial interval in an ordered linear space or cone, and states be normalized ones the dual space of that, and so forth. I won't go into detail about that side of things, but if you're interested in foundations, it's something to be aware of. Okay, so for instance, we might want to apply such a notion in, let's say, a condensed matter system, and hope that if the generalized entanglement relative to some suitably chosen set of observables of the ground state of a system, is likely to be weak, then maybe we can use, the unentangled states to do some, as a starting point for some approximation to study this system. So. We have motivations for this coming from a variety of directions. Okay, so what we'd like to do is generalize the notion of entanglement at least to a quantum system where we pick a special subspace of the space of observables. And we ask whether the pure state is or is not entangled relative to that subspace. So, I'm going to introduce this definition. I'm going to introduce a measure that we'll be using a lot, which is what we call a quadratic purity of the reduced state. Give some examples, including some fermionic examples. Talk about the situation where the set of special observables forms a Lie algebra. And then I'll talk about condensed matter applications. And if there's time, go on to measures of generalized entanglement, and whether there or not there are notions generalizing the notion of local operations of classical communication that you get from the standard notion of entanglement. Okay, so the setting is going to be a quantum system with a distinguished subspace of observables. And the idea is that these observables represent ones that perhaps are especially easy to measure, perhaps to control. They represent some limited means of processing these quantum states that might be, you know, physically distinguished, or maybe it's just especially mathematically useful for analyzing the problem at hand. There's no implication that, you know, that you can do nothing else, but this is a particularly easy set of observables to do, let's say, or just one you're particularly interested in. Okay, so we start by defining entanglement for pure states on the overall space. The definition is extremely simple. You look at the expectation values for your special observables induced by all pure states, or induced by your particular pure state, right? And that belongs to the set of expectation values. So you know, take a basis for this space of observables, right? Say there's, you know, K special observables. For any state, you know, make a list of the K expectation values of that basis of observables in that state. So that's a point in K-dimensional real vector space, if your observables are Hermitian. And now if you look at the set of states you get, the set of vectors of expectation values that you get from all possible quantum states, that's a convex set. Okay, so we call those sets of expectation values the reduced state, right? They're just linear functionals on these special space observables. And since it's a convex set, it's got extreme points. So it's a closed, compact, convex set. It has extreme points. And those are, we'll call, the pure reduced states. So these states on the special observables are, we'll call, reduced states. And then we're going to say that a pure state of the overall quantum system is entangled relative to this subspace of observables if and only if it induces a mixed state, a mixed reduced state on the special set of observables. So that's a key point that's worth understanding. So I'm happy to have questions if it's not clear. Let's take the example of standard entanglement, right? What are the special observables? Well, I've got Alice and Bob, let's say, it's bipartite. The special observables are those of the form A tends to the identity, an Alice observable, and the identity on Bob's side, or the identity tends to some observable B on Bob's side. Not A tends to B, right? That's measuring correlation. So, if you look at the reduced state relative to that subspace of observables, it's essentially just the pair of reduced density matrices, Alice's and Bob's. And then you can see that a pure state is entangled if and only if the reduced state is mixed. Right, if it's got so reduced states, I mean the pure states of these of this product space of observables are just the ones in which both Bob's and Alice's density matrices are pure. So that's fairly simple, perhaps trivial, but it's that feature of entanglement that we're generalizing to this generalized setting. Now, yes, Mike, Howard.
So just to clarify, so far. Nothing in the way you define that will lead to a unique measure of generalized entanglement, is that correct?
That's right. I mean, and I wouldn't expect a unique measure to exist any more than it does in the, in the multipartite case, let's say, or even the bipartite case. I mean, I guess there are reasons people think entropy, you know, might be special, or entanglement formation might be special. But in general, you know, certainly for finite dimensional systems, if you really want to talk about what can I do and can I not do with LOCC? There is no single measure that captures that. It's just not possible. So it won't be here either. But we're going to look a lot at a particular reduced measure, which is the analog of a trace of a squared reduced density matrix, which is our quadratic purity. So this quadratic purity, in the case of bipartite entanglement, is just going to be the average or the sum of the trace of the squares of the two reduced density matrices. Okay, so I've already gone over most of what's on this slide. Just like to point out that, is this too loud, by the way? Because I could be pretty loud without it, is that all right? Or should I use the thing? Yes, David.
In your example, you give, you had two set of observables, right? The A's and the B's.
Okay, you take a linear span of that.
Right, okay, so you won't have two sets in general. It'll just be one set.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And even in that linear span, right, there are observables that don't have that form. But that's a good point. Okay, and of course, if we need to extend this idea to mixed states, we do it the standard way, the same way you do generalized entanglement. Mixed state is generalized entangled, if and only if it cannot be written as a convex combination, non-trivial convex combination of unentangled pure states. Okay, so an important special case for us is going to be when the special set of observables is a Lie algebra, which I call G0 here, of traceless Hermitian operators. You can think of that as a distinguished family of Hamiltonians. I mean, I guess they could also have a trace. And then we can look at the Lie group. Okay, so one motivation for this, and one link of this to means of information processing, is let's say we have a Lie algebra of Hermitian operators, which might mean we have to take the Lie bracket as being a regular bracket times I or something, make a complex Lie algebra out of it, and I apologize if I say group instead of algebra sometimes, I tend to mush together, but make a complex Lie algebra out of it by just taking G and adding I times G to it, adjoining it as another space, and extending the bracket properly. So you can interpret these guys, these Hermitian ones, as generating unitaries. But in general, when you take exponentials of something in this full complex Lie group, you don't have to have unitaries, but you can think of those as natural Lie algebraically defined Krauss operators that you can use in defining completely positive maps that are distinguished dynamics with respect to these observables. And then you'll also want to topologically close what you get by exponentiating these things, because you want to be able to have projectors that are natural, but they're arbitrarily close to exponentials. Yes, Nicola.
Yeah. Okay, to the previous question, confused me. So if I had started two qubits in my local variable count, sigma z1 on every side plus sigma z on both sides.
Yes, that's
that
right.
That should be, if I start from a sigma zero. But if I use Gauss to suggest that the two reduced density matrices, so the two reduced density matrices, I lose all the correlations, so I mean, I get zero out of that.
So I'm not.
You said that we look only at these local observables, and that reduces so that the state on these subalgebra would be the reduced states, the partial states, where you trace over the other. And if you trace over the other part, you lose all the classical correlations.
So I guess I'm not sure what the problem is supposed to be. Do you think this definition is not going to distinguish?
Because the two density matrices rho A and rho B.
Yeah.
How am I going to see that the observable sigma z on any side plus sigma z on both sides gives the result of zero?
Well. I mean, if you have both density matrices, how are you going to see the entanglement? You cannot tell. Okay, here's the thing. You cannot tell from the reduced state whether or not you have an entangled state, right? So it's precisely the fact that you don't have that information you know, that makes the entangled state look mixed.
So you don't think that this is what you see as you do. You don't require that this is equal to a comprehensive definition.
Well, no. So look, the reduced state is really only to be thought of as a state on the algebra. So since sigma z tensor sigma z itself is not in the algebra, it
sigma z a analysis, sigma z tensor 1 plus 1 tensor sigma z. This is in the algebra.
Sure.
For example, people in the previous question.
Yeah.
In that one, I start from a single state, need to resolve zero. But by instead of a single state, I have these partial states.
They're both unpolarized if you have a single state, so you will get zero. If they're both completely unpolarized. So, I mean, maybe we should talk about this afterwards, but I don't think it's a problem. I'm not sure this is still in the right order, but we'll talk about the purity as a measure of this generalized entanglement. So off the top of my head, I'm not sure what the resolution is going to be to the last question, but I'm sure that it's going to work out okay. Okay, so we look essentially at the purity trace rho squared of the reduced state rho. And you can define this for the reduced states in the Lie algebra setting. And you can actually prove that if it's an irreducibly acting Lie algebra, then this measure is maximal precisely on the generalized unentangled states, the extremal ones. So we just take a basis for our algebra of subspace. And if we have some notion of what an orthogonal basis is, as we do in the Lie algebra, then you just take the sum of squared expectation values of the operators in your basis. That's invariant under a unitary change of basis in the operator subspace, for instance, under the adjoint action of the Lie group. Let's look at some examples that aren't the standard around the standard entanglement. So let's look at spin one. Spin S is actually also just about the same. Representation of SU2. So there's a basis minus 1, 0, and plus 1, which can be labeled by the eigenvalues of sigma z, right, you know, the spin in the z direction. So the reduced observable space, let's take just the spin observables. Right, there are initial operators in this 3D space that aren't spin, but let's just take those. Okay, so this quadratic purity then is just the sum of squared expectation values of the spins in x, y, and z direction. So the reduced state space is just a ball, just a unit ball in 3D real space. And you can see that minus 1 and 1 have pure reduced states, so we call them generalized unentangled, whereas 0 has maximally mixed reduced space, the zero spin. So, the unentangled pure states are precisely the spin coherent states. In fact, if you take SU2 as your special observables in a spin S system, the unentangled pure states are the spin coherent states. Okay, in fact, this is an example of a general theorem that we proved that if you take a general semi-simple Lie group and you make this definition and you have an irreducible representation, then the generalized unentangled states are precisely what you would naturally define as group theoretic coherent states for that for the group generated by the algebra. You just take a so-called highest weight state and you take its orbit under the Lie group generated by that algebra. So let's explain a little bit about what that means with a few concepts from representation theory. So a Cartan subalgebra, well, I guess at first I should say what semi-simple Lie algebra is. And we'll confine ourselves to, let's say, finite dimensional Lie algebras. So a semi-simple one, so a simple algebra, let's say, is an algebra that has no non-trivial ideals, right? No non-trivial sub-algebras that are invariant under the action of the algebra. When you exponentiate, this roughly corresponds to normal subgroups. So a semi-simple one is one that is basically just a product of simple ones. No abelian part in there. You could also add some abelian ideals, and that makes it a so-called reductive Lie algebra. And then maybe reasons for doing that, which come up when you think about this stuff in terms of superselection rules. But now it's semi-simple. So a Cartan subalgebra is just a maximal commuting subalgebra, right? So take the algebra of, let's say, traceless matrices. Pick some basis, all the ones diagonal in that basis form a Cartan subalgebra of that. Right? And Cartan subalgebras of a Lie algebra are conjugate under the Lie group generated by the algebra. Just as you can get, from any one commuting set of diagonal matrices, to the ones diagonal in any other basis just by conjugating by some matrix. Okay, in the spin example, the Cartan subalgebras are one-dimensional. They're just generated by choosing a spin component, sigma alpha, a direction. And they, sure enough, are conjugate under rotation, SU2 rotations. Okay, so once you choose a Cartan subalgebra, the representation decomposes into orthogonal subspaces called weight spaces, which are their common eigenspaces of the elements of your favorite, of the Cartan subalgebra that you've picked. Right, so there's a continuum of different decompositions depending on how you pick the Cartan subalgebra, but they're all sort of isomorphic. Okay, so in a spin, you know, representation of SV2, for instance, these are, okay, so they'll be, you know, spaces with different spin in the direction you've chosen. And so, as I said, each space has a distinct pattern of real eigenvalues for the Cartan's algebra basis elements, and that pattern is called a weight. And so in the spin example, the weights are just the expectation values of your chosen spin component. Okay, so the weights form a special kind of convex polytope, right? It's just a convex set that's generated by a finite number of points. And the extreme points are called the highest weights of the representation. And the states in the weight space that have that highest weight are called highest weight states. So these are the states, right, in the Hilbert space where your algebra is acting, where it's represented, such that when you act the Cartan sub algebra on them, the eigenvalues of everything, the things you get are that weight, that functional. Okay, so in our example, right, the spin 1, it's very simple. I mean, the polytope is just on the interval minus 1 to 1, and the space where, the real space where these weights live is just one-dimensional. And the extreme points are the endpoints. Okay. It's important to realize there's a continuous manifold of these highest weight states, and that's the orbit of any one such state under the Lie group, right? And you have to pick a different Cartan subalgebra to see that it's extreme in the weight space for that Cartan subalgebra. But if you pick the right one, you see that it's extreme. That it induces an extreme functional on the Cartan subalgebra. And so, basically, it's using this fact that the highest weight states are extreme in this weight polytope that you can show that the generalized unentangled states, which are supposed to be extreme in, they're supposed to generate extreme induced states in the states on the whole algebra, are actually highest weight states. Well, I can't find a slide that has the main theorem about irreducible. The algebra is called the state. Now, I've already said that the generalized unentangled states are coherent states in the sense of they're images of a highest weight state under the Lie group. They're also unique ground states. If you have a Hamiltonian that's generated by that, that's in that Lie algebra, and if it has a unique ground state, that's equivalent to being one of these generalized unentangled states, and vice versa. So there's a physical interpretation of these, if you like. And I believe, okay, so this is not actually in the theorem, but we believe that there are also states with the largest isentropy subgroup of the Lie group, the most symmetric states. But that part isn't actually proved. It's probably proved somewhere, not by us. Well, let's look at another example, which is more relevant to condensed matter. Let's say we have n sites, and we've got a fermion on each one, maybe this little 1D lattice. And so we can take the fermion creation operators, C dagger K, and construct a representation of the UN. And so the basis is really just going to be the bilinear fermion, bilinear expressions in the fermion creation operators, C dagger I, CI, and C dagger I, CJ, where I is not equal to J. And look at the Lie algebra that generates. Okay, well that generates a representation of U of N. sort of the way to see this like U of N is, think of C dagger as like a bra. C dagger sub I is like a electric cat with I inside it, and C sub I is like a bra with I inside it. And then C dagger I, CJ looks like the outer product of I and J, and you know, those, well, okay, if you take Hermitian linear combinations of those things, then, you know, you'll get U of N. In general, I guess you'll get SLN. Okay, if you throw in the ones with C dagger, and CC, you can get a representation of SO2N. And it turns out if you look at the BCS Hamiltonian, which I'll write up later, but the BCS Hamiltonian modeling superconductivity, then the ground state is always generalized and entangled in SO2N. It's a symmetrization of a state with definite numbers of Cooper pairs per mode. Or per mode that's available to Cooper pairs. Okay, so I mean, this is related to the idea that, for instance, in a fermionic system, Slater determinant states are unentangled, right? States with definite particle number. Here, these are states with definite Cooper pair number. Okay, well, those representations, and in particular, the representation of U of N, is a reducible representation. So the theorems I mentioned above don't apply. We're nevertheless going to use this purity to look at the ground state of this model as a sort of test bed for applying this to condensed matter systems. So I should say a little bit about what happens to purity when you do have a reducible representation. Okay, so let's let AAK be our basis for the algebra. And in a reducible representation, there are these non-trivial invariant subspaces. So all of these matrices for elements of the algebra are block diagonal, where the blocks are according to these invariant subspaces with zeros off them. So we'll call these blocks A super K sub I, the blocks of the K basis element. And then we'll expand an arbitrary state, psi, in terms of components on the blocks, but we'll normalize we'll absorb any phase of the states, we'll normalize the states and put the square root of probability outside. It's a normalized state. Okay, now if we look at the purity of expected Lie algebra, it's just the sum of the squared expectation values of our basis elements. We expand the state and the operator in terms of this block structure, remembering that the blocks are mutually orthogonal and the A's don't connect different blocks, we get something like this. Probabilities get squared. The square root of the probabilities get squared. We have these expectation values in the ith block and the jth block, and we're summing with these probabilities. Well, that's just a convex sum. Let's call this vector of expectation values of the k different basis elements for our space. Let's call it A sub I. So that's the vector of the expectation values for the normalized components in the different irrep sectors. And then K labels which basis element for the algebra of operators it is. So you get this expression. It's just a convex combination of some things, so it's less than or equal to the biggest one, and the biggest one is going to be you know, the inner product between two of these things, but we could that's going to be less than or equal to the absolute square of the largest of them. So the maximum purity is going to be just a maximum purity state is going to be concentrated on one airwrap, and it's going to have it's going to be an airwrap. It's going to be a maximum purity state within that airwrap, so it will be a coherent state in that airwrap. And we'll also choose the airwrap that's got the longest, the largest wave, the longest wave vector. Because this, that's essentially what we're going to get out of this area. However, that's not all the generalized unentangled states, according to our definition, right? Because it's possible to have, you know, when one thing is actually reducible, it's possible to have highest weight states in the other airwraps, maybe not as long, but they can still stick out and be extremal. Since I said the group is semi-simple, right, there's no abelian ideal, which means we don't have anything that's got, in these A operators, we don't have anything that really helps us distinguish which airwrap we've got. So we can't measure the airwrap unless we enlarge the group to have some abelian stuff that can use with everything. You know, which is fine, we can do that, but as I've stated it now, we can't measure the airwrap. So that means that the if you consider what happens when you have a state in one airwrap versus another, in the space of states on those state spaces, they're just going to be superimposed. You'll take the convex hull. And it's quite possible that even though the extremal ones in the polytope that you get from one of the airwraps are farther out, the other airwrap may be oriented in such a way that its shorter extreme points, are still extreme. It actually turns out in this VCS case, we didn't have that problem of the maximal purity was the same for all the sectors. The airwrap sectors here are just different fermion number sectors. They're fermion number sectors. And I'm not sure if this is really the purity or if it's 1 minus the purity, but it's simply related to the variance of fermion number. In fact, when you calculate what it is in the VCS ground state. Okay. So the VCS Hamiltonian is in this SO2N representation, where you can have CI dagger, CJ dagger. But we're looking at its purity with respect to this U of N subalgebra, and hoping that that might tell us something about phase transitions in this model. So, only for VCS states, or at least we only know that it's certain for VCS states, and it's not in general true, that purity is 1 minus the subnormalized version of the variance of fermion number. So we actually start out thinking of studying the anisotropic XY model. Nevertheless, this VCS Hamiltonian is directly relevant to it for reasons that I'll tell you, many of you probably know. So here's the anisotropic XY model. This is a 1D lattice of spins, not fermions, with nearest neighbor interactions. That's why you have the super I, super I plus 1 on the sigmas. And you've got sigma x interacting with a 1 plus gamma, sigma y with a 1 minus gamma. That's the gamma is the anisotropy parameter for that interaction. It's not actually that important to the story I'm going to tell here. And then you've got sigma zi, just like an external magnetic field, and another parameter g to tune the relative strength of that relative to the nearest neighbor interaction. So we'll be studying a phase transition that happens as you tune g, the relative strength of this nearest neighbor interaction, spin-spin interaction versus the external field. Okay, so this is all by a Jordan Wigner transformation, which is well known and probably was done in the 30s or something. So sigma I plus 1 here is just defined to be, that should be n, yes. Sigma alpha n plus 1 is just defined to be sigma 1. So it's as if the things are in a ring interacting neurostimulator. That's not focusing very well. It doesn't like green, I think. That's actually green, so that's a problem. Okay, so here's the Jordan Wigner transformation. We just defined some new operators. They're fermionic annihilation and creation operators, but they describe spinless fermions. Their CJ plus is defined to be. So the basic idea here,
you have sigma J plus right here.
So the basic idea is that, you know, flipping the spin up is like creating a fermion, and flipping it down is like not having a fermion there. You destroy the fermion. But if you really want fermionic creation, and you can't, since these are spin 1/2, you can't have two fermions at the same site. You can't flip the thing up twice. Right? It spins either 1 or 0, or 1 or minus 1. It's just like having a fermion or not. But to actually get fermionic commutation relations, you have to add this whole chain of operators of sigma z's to the left of it with a sign that depends on odd or even number of sigma z's. And so that makes the whole thing rather non-local, even though the crude idea is that having a spin pointing up is like having a fermion at the site. These are actually pretty non-local operators. And we can verify that they have the fermionic commutation relations. Even though you define them in terms of your spins. So now you write the Hamiltonian in terms of these operators, right? It's Hamiltonian, the same operator on the same space, but you're just writing it in terms of different set operators. And it looks like this, which is BCS Hamiltonian. So you can use the known solutions from that to solve this spin model. And I won't go through how that works. Okay, so we did that, and then we calculated the purity relative to this fermionic U of N subalgebra that I described before. So here's what we got, is we teamed up G. So as we tune up G on left to right along the bottom, we see that, I believe on this graph we've subtracted a constant from the purity. It doesn't actually go to zero. Okay, that's important. But the purity drops. At G is 1/2, there's a phase transition that's already well known. And the purity hits zero expectation value when you take a thermodynamic limit and it goes to infinity, and just stays zero. Now, the usual order parameter for this system is long-range magnetization. It acquires an expectation value at that point. Both of these things, right, have discontinuous derivatives at the point. In the quadratic purity, you've sort of found another order parameter that sort of has complementary behavior to the usual one. It acquires an expectation value where the usual order parameter has zero expectation value, and it has zero expectation value where the usual order parameter takes an expectation value. I guess on this slide we also have
nearest neighbor concurrence.
So there are ways of seeing this phase, same phase transition with nearest neighbor concurrence. I believe maybe an article by Fazio describes that, and there may be others. Okay, so if you look at the purity, in terms of the absolute value of the deviation, so on this axis we have a log of the absolute value, the distance from the critical point of this coupling parameter. Compare the magnetization, which I guess is C on this thing, and the purity. They're both giving you the same, they're both giving you scaling with the same exponent. But one is sort of below the straight line, one's above it, because they're getting their expectation value on opposite sides of the transition. This is probably not
relevant.
Okay, this is just showing, and this is actually for some finite n, I believe, which I'm not sure what it is. So it's not a thermodynamic limit. But showing that at the high g's,
the high values of this exponent would be like half the n. So this is sort of the distribution of a fermion number. And as you reduce g, it's moving along. It looks like the variance is pretty constant. And then gets squished. As you go below the transition, this thing starts getting narrower and narrower.
The distribution of fermion number. Right, so we have several papers on this, and they go on to discuss some possible measures of generalized entanglements, something about other muscle applications. There's another solid-state model which I find not as compelling as this application, actually. But we also discuss, how about you generalize the notion of local operations in classical communication to this, say. I've already given you a little bit of an idea that you can define special, the algebraically special sets of Krauss operators. We have some measures of entanglement which we've been able to show are monotone under our generalizations of local operations of classical communication. But we've also found only been able to show them monotone when you take a convex combination of unitary operations in the Lie group, not something that you make out of Krauss operators in the Lie group. So if you're mathematically inclined, that's probably an interesting open question. Just to try to show these are monotonic or find others. I guess I wanted to make one more remark about super selection rules in NMR, because NMR came up this morning. So the way we think about NMR and collective operations generally is, let's say we have n d-dimensional systems. We take a representation of SLD, but it's the tensor representation that essentially acts by, you know, a given, the usual representation matrix, d-dimensional representation matrix, just tensored up n times. So that forces you to do the same thing on all systems. Now, I think the reason that, you know, we don't, I think you don't get spin squeezing, for instance, that way. And so I was talking to Steve this morning, and he was mentioning, well, spin squeezing is generated by an operator like J squared. So that's actually going to commute with everything. Well, so let's say you have a bunch of spins, right? Then J squared should commute with everything, yeah?
I was saying J squared.
Okay, JZ squared. Yeah, all right, so that's not going to be, I'm going to think of that. All right. Yeah, so I'm not sure I would know how to represent JZ squared. Yeah, you probably have to go to a different group if indeed a group is the right way to represent it. Okay, so anyway, that's, you know, that's not going to be, I suppose, in, okay, so Let me just add on an important distinction might be, right, whether you can or cannot measure the air back in these situations where you have reducible representations and therefore you have invariant subspaces, which I'm sort of correlating with some kind of superselection rule, and that you can't have superpositions. Or if you do have superpositions, the coherence in them is not accessible to you by this reduced means of information processing. But it is a, you know, it is an important difference in resources whether you have the ability to measure the IRRAD or to find out something about the IRRAD as you can, or whether you don't. And in the case of semi-simple D algebras I'm discussing, you don't have that ability, so you're likely to be able to do less than if you can measure the IRRAD. Whereas I guess if you generally think of a super selection rule and just look at, right, what are the operators in the commutant of the group that you've symmetrized over, and you say, I can do things that are in the commutant because they're invariant under this group. Then when you look at these blocks, and you look at that associative algebra, you probably do get the ability to measure the IRRAS. And so the difference in power between having that and not might be something you should investigate. So I think I'll leave it there. There's many papers you can find on the archive about this, and the latest one with the anisotropic XY model and the details is going to be in FISREV A pretty soon. There's a FISREV letters from early last year, and then there's an even earlier FISREV A, which if you really like all the mathematical stuff and the convex cones, that's a problem. And the open problems, that's a good one to do. So thanks.
We have a few minutes for questions.
A question and a comment. The question, what you gave one characterization of unentangled unentangled states in this notion of generalized entanglement as being ones that are ground states of the Hamiltonian in your Lie algebra.
Right, so that's more specialized because it applies only to the Lie algebra.
It does apply only to the Lie algebra.
Well, so as far as I thought, that doesn't mean.
That was my question, whether it does, and if so, why? Because it seemed to apply for the like your LOCC restriction. It makes sense, perfect sense there.
Okay, that is a fact. LOCC is the algebraic.
Okay,
it's just the local Lie algebras of all matrices.